There was a major study done by the Fuller Youth Institute that found something interesting. That young people and their parents have lost the ability to do something. And they chronicled it, they documented it. It's just like a lost art between parents and their kids. And what they found that they've lost is their ability to talk about their faith. Researchers for the National Study for Youth and Religion discovered that young people have become inarticulate about their faith. They just don't have the language to express their beliefs and convictions, but so have their parents. They said it's like with their parents, they learned Mandarin as a young person and then they forgot it as an adult. And over time, both parents and kids have just become less fluent in faith. We're in a series on doing family that we're actually bringing to a conclusion today. And we've covered a lot of ground. How to do marriage and respect for authority and time and communication and conflict resolution. Today we come to how do you do faith, something we can't afford to forget how to talk about. So we're going to cover a lot of ground today. And as you would imagine, if you're going to talk about how to do faith as a family, you're going to start off with marriage. The bedrock of the family unit. And so if you're going to talk faith and family, you got to talk faith and marriage first and foremost. You know, there's four levels to any marriage relationship. And whenever I talk and teach about marriage, I usually go over these because it's such an important thing to understand. The first level of intimacy within marriage is the physical side of things, just finding somebody attractive. That's also the most superficial of the four. It made you first look their way, probably, but it's not enough to sustain a relationship over a long haul. Then there's the intellectual level where you challenge and you stimulate one another. You share thoughts and ideas, and you have these robust and deep and fun conversations. And then there's the emotional level of intimacy. This is when you really just enjoy each other's company and you have a certain amount of chemistry together and you get along and you like being together. They're your best friend. They make you laugh. They're the ones you want to watch that movie with and then talk about it, the one you want to take that trip with. So you've got the physical and you've got the intellectual and you've got the emotional. Most people stop there. And if they've got those three in place, they just think of themselves as having found their soulmate. But in truth, they haven't even gotten to the soul level yet, because there is a fourth level, and that level is the spiritual level, when you relate to each other in light of your mutual connection with God. Your soul, your spiritual life is the deepest part of who you are. And when that is shared with your spouse, have it in common with your spouse, you have it together, communing with God, sharing those values and priorities and commitments, then your intimacy is at the deepest and highest level, which means that the journey toward full and complete intimacy with each other as a married couple is ultimately a spiritual journey. But if you don't reach that level, then it's just not a shared dynamic of your relationship. It's going to forever remain unexplored territory. I don't care how strong the relationship is or how well you get along with each other. This is the whole idea of the two becoming one, a deeply biblical idea. Here's how Jesus put it. He said, haven't you read that at the beginning, the Creator made them male and female? And that he said, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they're no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. Well, that's the goal of marriage. Such intimacy, such bonding that the two become one. But becoming one is a God thing. It's a spiritual act. You can't get that close apart from connecting spiritually. If Christ isn't present in both lives, he can't join you together. He can't be the tie that binds. You have to share spiritual territory to cross over to each other in and through that territory. So if you want to do faith as a family, you've got to do faith as a couple. Anything and everything about faith in your home is going to come at its best out of the overflow of what you have individually and what you have collectively as a couple spiritually, as husband and wife, which raises a very important question. What do you do when that faith isn't shared? What do you do when there's a spiritual mismatch? Well, Let me talk about that. I mean, that could be a whole series on its own, but it's a very common thing, particularly here at MEC, because 70% of our growth comes from people who are previously unchurched. It's very common for two people to come exploring Christianity. Neither one are particularly people of faith. One becomes a Christ follower. The other is still kind of checking things out. And so we have a whole bunch of kind of spiritual mismatch kind of dynamics going on here. Let me just say a couple of words on that, even though a lot more could be said. First, what do you do if you're the faith person in that relationship? You're kind of on the Jesus side of it, and your spouse isn't. What do you do? Well, let me start off with what you shouldn't do. You shouldn't be annoying. Just don't shove it down their throat. Exercise appropriate restraint. The Bible says this. It says, if anybody asks you why you believe as you do, be ready to tell them, but do it in a gentle and respectful way. Now, that's not what you're going to want to do. Here's what you're going to want to do. You want to go sneak into his car and turn the radio station to a Christian radio station so it kicks on when he starts it in the morning. You're going to want to put Bible post-it notes on his mirror. You're going to want to stick books in her suitcase before she heads out on a trip. Go easy. Take the Bible's advice. Be ready to share, but do it with restraint. And you know what's the best way to do that? The Bible says focus on living out your faith. Focus on you. In fact, here's the specific counsel for someone who's in a spiritually mismatched marriage. It says, there are husbands who, indifferent as they are to any words about God, will be captivated by your life of holy beauty. What is going to be most convincing to your spouse is to simply let God do his work in you. Have him just change you into the person he wants you to be, your character and your attitudes and your outlook. And as they see you becoming more and more of a person of integrity and humility and gentleness and grace and love and self-sacrifice, they're going to be forced to look at the reality of Christ's presence in your life. Now, to those of you who are not the Christian in the relationship, let me tell you about a kind of conversation that I've had with what feels like 1,000 people, usually men. Who aren't where their wife is at spiritually. We sit down and they say, okay, listen, I'm not sure where I stand with all this stuff. I'm just not, you know, particularly religious guy. And inside I'm saying, neither am I, but keep going, you know. They say, I'd like to think I'm spiritual, but, you know, I connect with God better on the golf course or on a boat or on a hike than I do anywhere. I mean, my parents went to church and I was raised Christian and all that stuff. And that's pretty much, I guess, where I still land. But who knows what's true or how to interpret the Bible or what's right or who's right. But my wife is really into it and she wants me to be into it. And I know it's, you know, good for the kids, but I'm just not there. And I got questions, you know, about science and evolution and all kinds of stuff that I'm just not sure what I'm supposed to do here. And you know what I say to all that? I tend to say, okay, fair enough. I mean, and thanks for shooting straight with me. And trust me, I get it. I get it. So here's, if you're asking me, I'll tell you what I would say to you, and you do with it what you want. You love your wife and you want to support her, right? Right. You love your kids and you want them to have a solid foundation of values, right? And you like the Christian values, and so you'd like that in their life, right? Right? You say you're spiritually open, but you got a lot of questions, which sounds like you would be open to exploring things, right? Yeah. Okay. I'm not finding the problem. I mean, what's the issue here? Why can't you chase after all three? I mean, since this is high stakes, I mean, we're not talking about a warm fuzzy on a yoga mat on a 3-day sweat lodge retreat. We're talking things like heaven and hell and eternity and Jesus. So that's worth that intellectual exploration you say you're open to, right? So explore. I mean, MEC is wide open design for that. You're going to be with a whole bunch of other people exploring it too. And you're right. Your kids need something that they're not going to get in school or on Instagram or from a friend. They need those values and everything about this church and MEC Kids and all that we offer. I mean, it's just going to come right up next to you with that. So bring them and get them involved and get those values cooking in their life. And you know that marriage is about doing things in lockstep and supporting and encouraging and sharing. And you want to do that with your wife and you want to do that for your wife. And And so it sounds to me like joining your wife with this and bringing your kids here and exploring it on your own. Win, win, win. What's the downside to all this? Have you ever heard of Pascal's wager? He was a French intellectual in the 17th century who put all this stuff with God in terms of a wager. And this is how he put it. He says, listen, you're going to bet with your life in one of two ways. You're either going to bet that there is a God, or you're going to bet that there's not a God. Now, if you live your life like there is a God, and then there is, you won. You won. If you live your life like there isn't, and there is, you're screwed. That's the translation from the French. If you live your life like there is and there isn't, you've lost nothing. Nothing. So when it comes to living as if there is a God or exploring whether there is a God, you have everything to gain and nothing to lose. So for your sake and the sake of your family, you know, attend and support and explore. It's a no-lose scenario. Well, let's move from marriage to kids. How do you handle kids and faith? This is a huge issue for parents, particularly because of what it is we're told about parenting. Here's what we're told about parenting. When it comes to faith, yes, you may want your kids to be people of faith, but you've got to let them decide for themselves. You got to let them be in the driver's seat, and they've got to have that steering wheel when it comes to faith. And everything swirling around us as parents hammers that message home. That we shouldn't shove religion down their throat. We shouldn't make them go to church. We shouldn't force our beliefs onto them. And when you hear words like shove and make and force, it makes you feel like you should back off and become spiritually passive. And that's really the mantra of our day. Be spiritually passive. It's almost like, you know, you raise your kid, you know, you want to raise your kid gender neutral, raise them faith neutral. That's garbage. And that's a really, really awful lie. Nothing could be further from the truth. Friends, there's no place for being spiritually passive in the home. The entire dynamic of parenting is that children are immature and we as parents are mature. And our children need our maturity. They need our leadership. And nowhere do they need it more than when it comes to spiritual things. Because the stakes on this couldn't be higher. Your child right now faces a life that will either have God in it or not. Be guided by God or not. Have values rooted in God or not. And after that, your child faces an eternity that will either be with God or not. So what should a parent do in relation to that choice? Everything they can. And make no mistake about it, it is a parent's responsibility to do everything they can. It is your job. Let me read you some of the most important parenting advice that has ever been given from the Bible. It comes from Moses, one of the most famous personalities in biblical history, used by God in phenomenal ways. And toward the end of his life, as the people of Israel were getting ready to enter the famed promised land, he gathered them all together and gave them his final words, the culmination of his wisdom, one last life lesson, what God had most impressed on his spirit as they would go forward in history. And you know what it was he wanted to talk to them about? How to pass on your faith to your kids. That was number one on the agenda. Let me read his words. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands. Bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. This was a full court press for Moses. He lays out the most important parenting principle there is. When it comes to faith in the home, faith in your children, you are to be wildly intentional. To use his words, you have to impress it on your children. And the word used for impress there that we translate impress was a Hebrew word that literally meant sharp. to the ideas that when it comes to parenting our children spiritually, we're to be doing it in a way that drives it down deep into their soul. It should be sharp like a knife, penetrating, going deep within. So you as a parent not only have to be the one taking responsibility for your child's spiritual formation, you've got to be doing it in the most spiritually penetrating, intentionally penetrating, permeating way you can imagine. So are you? Or are you doing what a lot of parents do, which is drop-off parenting? You know about drop-off parenting, right? It's when you drop your kids off to somebody or something to do something for you. You want your kids to learn soccer, so you drop them off at soccer. You want them to learn how to play the piano, so you drop them off at piano lessons. You want them to be educated, so you drop them off at school. You want them to have friends, so you drop them off for a play date. And it makes sense, right? Outsource for specialties. But here's one thing you don't want to add to that list, and this might surprise you. You want them to know about God, so you drop them off at church. That is a drop-off that won't work. That is a drop-off that will not work, not if it's all you do. Let me tell you how I've tried to get this across whenever I've talked about this before. I want you to take a look at this jar of gumballs. There's exactly 40 gumballs here. And you know what they represent? They represent 40 hours. The 40 hours on average that we have with your child in a year. We as a church have 40 hours. After vacation and the kids, when they get sick or all the different kinds of things that can take you away. For the average really well-churched family, we've got about 40 hours a year with your child. That's it. 40 hours to talk about God, who Jesus is, who the Holy Spirit is, why the cross is important, how to have a personal relationship with God. 40 a year. But that's really not typical, is it? The average person comes, what, once or twice a month? Or if you don't have custody of your children, maybe you only can get your child here every other week. So what is it, 15 to 20 hours a year that we have your child to invest in? That's not much. Now compare that to this. This is the number of hours you have with your child. You have 3,000 hours a year with your child. You tell me where they're going to be won or lost. You tell me where the battle is going to be won. You tell me what's going to have the most influence, the most impact on their life. 3,000 or 40. Is drop-off stuff going to work for you? Not a shot. Not even a shot. Now, having said that, let me go ahead and tell you, these 40 matter. They matter disproportionately. That's why I purposefully have these gumballs be so much bigger than these. Because these are really hypercharged. Unbelievable amounts of time and preparation go into each one, particularly here at MEC. But you can't rely on these 40 alone. These 40 are designed to serve this. They're designed to set you up for your 3,000. These 40 are the ones that prime the pump for you to do your thing. These 40 are designed to be taken and used in and through your 3,000. Now, I want to talk about these hours some more. I want to talk about these 40 and these 3,000. You do know you're in charge of them, right? Your kid is not. You are in charge of these. Not your child. At least you're supposed to be. So let's get back to this whole idea of children deciding about all this for themselves. They shouldn't. You should. At least if all of this is real for you, here's what you need to settle in the deepest part of who you are as a parent, the deepest part of what you believe as a parent, the deepest convictions that you hold as a parent. Is your faith a matter of personal taste or transcendent truth? Which is it? If it's just your taste, then it's not any different than a favorite color or the food you like to eat, the kind of music you enjoy listening to, whether you're a beach person or a mountain person, whether you like football or basketball better. It's all preference. You know, you like Jesus, they like Buddha, they're into Muhammad, no big deal. It's just taste. But if it's not about taste, but about truth, Well, then it all changes, doesn't it? Then all this becomes electric. If it's about truth, then you're battling for your child's very soul, and it's about right and wrong, and good and evil, and heaven and hell. It's about where they stand before a living God and what's going to happen when they stand before that living God and give an account for their one and only life. It's about where they're going to spend eternity. If this is all about taste for you, okay, relax. Let them decide on their own. Deal with faith in the most laissez-faire, laid-back, shrug of the shoulders, whatever kind of approach possible. Because it doesn't matter. You don't really believe in all this heaven and hell stuff anyway. You don't really believe there's going to be anything that happens after this life. You don't believe there's anything really much more deeper than full personal fulfillment. It's just taste. But if it's about truth, if it's about reality, if there really is a God on the loose who has made himself ultimately known through Jesus, and it is through Jesus alone that we can be in that saving relationship with God, then this becomes the most important investment and responsibility of all. There's nothing else on the parenting plate that even comes close to you and your child and their faith. Yes, your child has to make their own choice, but if it's about truth, you're going to want to do everything you can to help them make that choice. And that means when they're too young to choose, you choose for them. Isn't that the way all parenting works? Would you let your child put their hand on top of a hot stove while saying to yourself, well, you know, he's got to see for himself whether it's hot or not? Would you let him walk out into traffic saying, well, you know, he really needs to make his own decision whether or not it's bad to get hit by a car? Would you hand them a fork and say, look, I'm going to give you this fork. I don't want to push my views on you. There are certain ways that I've come to have beliefs about forks, but you need to find out whether or not the electrical socket really is right for you or not right for you. So I've taken out all the plugs, and I'm going to give you this fork, and I'm going to be praying for you. Crazy, right? They don't have the maturity to make those kinds of decisions at that point in their lives. They need you to tell them what is right and wrong, true and good, what to believe, what not to believe. So why would we drop parenting 101 common sense that we apply to every other aspect of their life? Why would we suddenly drop that when it comes to the most important aspect of their life at all? I don't get it. Why would we bend over backwards to be the parent in the room in every area but spirituality, which is the most important? So let's get real nuts and bolts about this. If this is truth for you, and again, you taste people can kind of log out and whip out your phones and play Angry Birds. If this is truth for you, then this means that when they're young, you don't ask your child if they want you to read them a Bible story. You read it to them. You don't ask them if they want to say their prayers. You have them say their prayers. You don't ask them if they want to go to church. You take them to church. And friends, let me go ahead and offend as many of you as I possibly can, because I'm just getting warmed up. When you get here, don't turn to little Johnny or Sally at the door and say, do you want to go to big church or do you want to go to children's church? Don't do that. Now, I'm not trying to make those of you with kids by your side right now feel awkward. They may be sick. You may have them with you for a reason. But when they are healthy, if you care about their spiritual formation, get their scrawny little butt into Met Kids. And if they kick and scream and put up a fit, just smile and say, kick and scream and have a fit in there. They'll get over it. And when they do, you'll find out they had an absolute blast. And here's why. They were in something designed top to bottom for them. An experience designed to turn them on to God at their level. Keeping them in here does absolutely no good. They're not going to get it. They're going to be bored. Once the music is over, they're going to hate it. Do you want to have church be as bad for them as it was for you growing up? What are you after? Put them where they will get it. They need you to do that for them as their parent. Now, I got a last 5% on this. I got a last 5%. And it's about prioritizing spiritual things and being intentional with your children and imposing and impressing this on them. Do it with as much fervor and passion and commitment as you do their sports. Yes, I'm going there. I love sports. I believe that on the eighth day, God created ESPN. I played organized sports from grade school all the way through to college. All four of my children were involved in sports during their formative years, from basketball to football, and swim team to gymnastics. I even coached years of basketball when my boys were on teams with the YMCA and AAU. I believe sports are a good and healthy investment for parents to make. I believe that parents need to make some sacrifices even to have your children involved in appropriate ways. But here's the inevitable but that's coming to all this. Studies show that one of the biggest challenges to making spiritual investments in your child are the sports investments that can compete with it. Can I tell you some things I've heard floating around on the cloud? I've actually overheard people say things like, yes, we're going to do family night. It's one of the coolest things Mech does. We're going to do family night. Wouldn't miss it for the world. But obviously until soccer starts. Oh, my. Or, we're doing Met Kids on weekends. Are you kidding me? My kids love it. But, I mean, you know, what do you do when swim team starts? What do you do? Got to do swim team. Max Life, oh, yeah, I mean, we're all for it. But then, you know, once spring rec league starts. Friends, I want us to just think about what it is we're saying. Really, I would challenge you, go into your bathroom, shut and lock the door, stand in front of the mirror, and say it out loud. Listen to the words that you're living in its naked form. You are saying, I will do spiritual things for my child's sake until sports conflict. Then sports win. Because sports is the ultimate value and their true salvation. I worship sports. It is my God. Just say it. Just say it. When our kids were younger, my wife Susan and I saw this one coming. We wanted our kids to be involved in those events every bit as much as anybody else. But with some of the sports, there kept being some conflicts and particularly with church and spiritual investments. And so we decided, you know, we got to take a stand. What matters most to us? So for every team and every league, we'd put the same thing down when we registered, because you can put down, you know, when you're available for practices and stuff like that. We would ensure that there was at least one weekend service our children could attend. We didn't care whether it was Saturday night or Sunday morning, but one weekend service that they could attend. Further, we let the coaches know in advance those select Friday evenings when family night would be offered and we would not be able to participate. There was even a season in our church's life when our boundaries included not only weekend services, but also Wednesday nights. For us, that was a very important investment. And so we went through all those years that way. And in all those years of parenting involving four children heavily involved in sports, we never once had a kid penalized. We never once had anybody kick us off a team. We never once felt we deprived our kids of anything substantive. And even if we had, who gives a flip? I mean, it's not that wasn't important. Their hearts were what was important. Their character was what was important. What they were gaining spiritually was paramount. That's what mattered. And they turned out fine. Well, three out of the four turned out fine. Our kids were valedictorians, athletes. They got prestige college acceptances, scholarships, good marriages, all the things parents are so insecure about that we think somehow, you know, lacrosse is the answer. More important, all four know Christ intimately. That's the win. They know Christ. I've seen too many parents make sports their priority as if that is what is most important to raise their children in a healthy and holistic way, only for me to then see that child travel far from God during their high school or college years, or leave the faith altogether as a young adult for all the wrong reasons. Oh, they had field hockey. They had basketball. They had soccer. They were on the swim team, but they didn't walk away with much of Jesus. And I'll tell you something. You take any 25-year-old person and you say, okay, you had, you know, swim team at 10, but would you rather have Jesus now at 25? Do you wish you could go back and have some of those high school, college years over again? Any regrets there spiritually? Friends, hear my heart. This is not about choosing between Jesus and sports. At least it doesn't have to be. But if it comes down to that choice, how exactly does soccer rank over your child's eternity? You're going to have to tell me. You're going to have to help me with that one. How is it we'll spend half a day traveling to a volleyball tournament but fail to protect an hour a week where they will learn about God? Okay, I'm done. Send your emails to jimwhite@idontcareitneededtobesaid.com. Now, how does all this play out as a child ages? Because I've been focusing on the youngest of ages. Well, there's three, three stages that, and you need to consciously maneuver each one of these stages and how these play out with intentionality in the faith. The first stage that I've been spending most of my time on is the stage where you intentionally indoctrinate them. Now, I know the word indoctrinate may sound like a terrible, bad, horrible, no good word, but it shouldn't. It's a great word. Indoctrinate simply means you put doctrine in, you put truth in, you instruct, you teach your child. I mean, that's your job. In the early years, yes, indoctrinate. Then as they get older, intentionally educate. Help them to understand it all, to connect the dots, to not just know what they believe, but why they believe it. Explain things. Help them to just not know it, but to get it. They're going to have questions. Encourage those questions. Don't be intimidated by them, and don't shut them down. Talk about it with them. My son Jonathan went through a severe crisis of faith where he questioned everything. We didn't freak. We just tried to serve it. We worked at answering his questions. We gave him books, helped him in any way we could. We took it seriously. We took him seriously. And we created an open and honest space for him to voice questions and doubts and concerns. As many of you know, he ended up going to seminary and being ordained and serves as a pastor here at MAC. He has one of the deepest faiths of any man I know. He's a better man than I am. Much better. But here's why. Like many young people, the biggest hindrance to his faith wasn't doubt. You know what would have been the biggest hindrance to faith? Silence. Silence. To have met the questions with silence. Your children, particularly as they age, they need to be able to express their questions and concerns and doubts about faith. Did you know that the latest surveys find that 70% of all church-going high schoolers, report having serious doubts about faith? 70%. You know what I would say to those high school kids? Those young men and women, I would say, you know what? You are so normal. That's normal. Doubt away. Ask away. It's legal. You know what I would say? I mean, if it's true, it'll stand up under any amount of intellectual scrutiny. I mean, nobody should be weirded by this. Ask anything you want to ask. Chase anything you want to chase. And you know what I would say to their parents? You be normal. Don't get all weird on them. Let them ask. Let them doubt. Walk with them through it. See, doubt is not unbelief. The very meaning of doubt means that you're in two minds. You're wavering, you're deciding, you're processing things. Ever done any of that? Isn't it kind of normal? Okay. So ever thought about taking your high schooler out to coffee and asking them some probing spiritual questions? Like, what is something you don't believe that you think I still believe? Interesting question. What is something you believe that you don't think I believe? When do you feel closest to God? Do you still believe in God? If they say, well, I'm not sure, tell me about this God you're not sure about. Describe him for me. And then probably when they do, you're going to be able to say, oh, I don't believe in that God either. because their view of God has become so distorted by culture and its caricatures as opposed to the true biblical image. By the way, you want some help with these questions? Letting your kids process their faith. Let me put a plug in right now for one of the coolest things that we've just started here at MEC, which is our new Institute Classes for Kids. The MEC Institute is our community college. For the church and all things faith, you can take classes on anything from how to pray all the way up to graduate level courses in systematic theology. We've just launched a series of classes for kids, and a new slate starts in 2 weeks, 2 weeks from tomorrow. And the reason we're doing that is because we just offered these classes. They had their first start a week ago, this past Monday, and I was here seeing it all in action. It was amazing. But the reason we're doing it is because they all filled, like almost like that, every single one of our kids' classes. And so we're offering those same classes again coming up in 2 weeks. One is on learning how to talk to God and hear from him through prayer, and the children learn the Lord's Prayer and how to use it in their life. There's another one that's craft-based. They actually make a lamp as part of the class, and while they do, they learn how they can be a light to their world. There's another class called Cold Case Christianity, and it's about understanding why you believe what you believe. Children become detectives to investigate the claims of Christianity. There's one called Grapple, which grapples with the tough questions related to salvation, like who gets to go to heaven and what is sin and why does it matter? These are just cool. I don't know anything like them. If I had my kids at home right now, I would be so over all this. I'd clear the schedule in any way I needed to get them here. And they're all offered through our MEC Institute. You can register online at our website. I just can't be, imagine being a parent today and not taking advantage of this stuff. I can't imagine having a middle schooler not crawling over broken glass to get them here for Max Life every week, knowing what it is that they're learning and talking about and dealing with. Same thing with real life for our high school students. Well, anyway, after you indoctrinate and then as they get a little older, educate, the final stage is to help them navigate, to help them just make the ultimate final choices, to help them find their way spiritually, to encourage them toward following true north. Walk with them, help them along the way as they journey through life. To this day, I have navigating conversations with my kids. To this day. They're all married with kids of their own, but because we opened the door long ago, faith conversations flow free and they flow fast. Though the final decision was their own, all four of my children have entered into a relationship with Christ. All four, though I didn't pressure this at all, if anything, the opposite, all four wanted to go into vocational ministry for their lives and did. And here's why. It's not because Susan and I were perfect parents. It's because the Bible works. And you know why it works? Because it's true. These principles, it's just the way to do it, friends. You follow, anybody can follow these principles. Susan and I had Christ at the center of our lives, and as a result, the center of our marriage. We've been intentional about passing our faith on to our children. We took impressing it on them seriously. And as the years went by, we chose to indoctrinate and then educate and now to navigate. It's just how we did family. And the reason we knew to do family that way is because the Bible told us. We have no regrets. Neither do our kids. You can have this family too. Knowing how to do it isn't a secret. All right, well, I'll stand for a quick closing prayer. Next week, I'm going to start a series to try to teach you how to make the worst possible decisions for your life. I'm excited about this. I feel it's my pastoral calling. Really, if you think about it, the reason everything you read about is how to make a good decision. So why do we keep making bad decisions? It's because we really don't know how to spot a bad decision on the front end. We have no clue. Really, we don't. Or else we wouldn't make bad decisions. So we're going to walk through four case studies that give the four principles, the four ways you can make an atrocious decision. You're not going to want to miss it because you will, as you heard Megan say, learn from that exactly much better how to make a good decision. So that's next week. Bring fun with it. It's going to be really important stuff. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this series, all that we've learned through it. And I pray that today, whatever it was you wanted to say to us, challenge us, wherever you wanted to step on our toes, whatever you wanted to correct with us, that we heard it without defensiveness. And that we'll take it seriously because we really do want kids that love you. We want a marriage with you at the center. We want to do faith as we do family. So help us to have ears to hear what was in your scriptures. And so I pray that for all of us in the name of Jesus. Amen.